The struggle for freedom from British domination and the pro-British regime then in power throughout the Arab world was to become, as Saddam would put it later, the mother of all battles, unquote. One facet of Ba'athist ideology helps shed some light on the origin of Saddam Hussein's political beliefs. To the Ba'athists, the Arab world formed a single nation united by language, culture, and religion. That religion was Islam, the Ba'ath founders insisted, even though they themselves were Christians. Opposed to this Arab, quote, nation, unquote, which had been splintered by an imperialist conspiracy, were the Arab regions, the nation-states that had come into being during the 20th century, whose borders the Ba'athists considered as artificial relics of the colonial era. When the Ba'athists talked about the regional command, they meant the Iraqi or the Syrian Ba'ath party, whereas the national command referred to a theoretical body where regional leaders from the various Arab states would meet to determine the fate of the larger nation, unquote. Like many prophets before them, the early Ba'athists believed that their prayers would become flesh in the body of a great leader, a man destined to rule the Arab nation with an iron will. Under his leadership, 50 million Arabs would rise up and expel the Jews and the colonial powers from the Middle East. Until then, the Arab world would remain fragmented, weak, and submissive. Hero worship was not the only similarity between the Ba'athist and Nazi ideologies. Both believed in racial identity, in foreign devils, and in war as purification. As Aflaq wrote on the eve of his party's creation, when the ashes of the Nazi dream had not yet gone cold, quote, real struggle can never be destruction, negativeness, or inaction. It is creativeness, a building, a fruitful and positive action, unquote. War was great, the young Ba'athists surrounding Saddam believed. Long live its purifying fire. And bear in mind some of the ideological similarities between the Ba'athist party and the Nazi party of Germany. I would note that the ethnocentrism of the Ba'ath party also is an element of commonality with the Zionist movement itself. And bear in mind the German who spied for Iraq. What we're going to do next is to listen to a section of the very first of my archive shows, Uncle Sam and the Swastika, from May 23rd of 1980. And what we're going to do is listen to a section about that archive show about the recapitalization of Germany under the Dawes and Young plan, and in particular pay attention to two companies, one IG Farben and also Vereinigte Stahlwerke, or United Steel. We're going to come back to these, and we're going to take a look at the role of some of the same corporations that were involved in the transatlantic financial and industrial axis that was instrumental not only in helping to bring fascism to Germany, but also that was instrumental in that basically provided Hitler with his war-making industries. Because many of those same corporations, part of that transatlantic financial and industrial axis, were operant again prior to and during the Persian Gulf War. Again, what we're going to hear now is a section from Uncle Sam and the Swastika, recorded May 23rd of 1980.
Into this gap stepped a group of diplomats who were also key international financiers. Many of the most important of them were American. Their solution to the problem of German reparations was to arrange for a series of foreign loans in order to enable Germany to continue the reparations payments. These loans were set up under two different programs. One was called the Dawes Plan, D-A-W-E-S, of 1924. The other was called the Young Plan, and that was instituted in 1929. Now, between 1924, and 1931, under the Dawes and Young Plan, Germany paid out a total of 36 billion marks in reparations. In the meantime, during that same period of time, they borrowed 33 billion marks, of course, at a great profit to the institutions lending them, so that the net payment by Germany was only 3 billion marks over the seven-year period. Now, what this had the effect of doing was to concentrate economic power, because in the harsh conditions which the Dawes and Young plan imposed, the businesses which best survived were those that had access to the American loans. It was a very effective device for eliminating competition. And in fact, some of the firms used their loans in order to buy out their competition in Germany by paying higher than market prices. The chief result of the concentration of economic power which stemmed from the conditions set up by the aforementioned Dawes and Young plan was the formation of three giant cartels, one of them the IG Farben industry, which we were talking about a while ago, That was a chemical concern. The second was Vereinigte Stahlwerke, or United Steel. And the third was German General Electric, 30% owned, by the way, by American GE. These three companies comprised the backbone of German defense production. They essentially were Hitler's tools for forging the Wehrmacht and the Luftwaffe. And it's also important to note that these same industrial concerns played a key role in financing Hitler's takeover in 1933.
So remember the names IG Farben and Vereinigte Stahlwerke. IG Farben, the huge and immensely important German dyestuffs industry, was the parent company that not only provided the backbone of Hitler's war-making production, they also made the Zyklon B that was used in the gas chambers in the concentration camps during World War II. We're going to turn now to a book called The Crime and Punishment of IG Farben. That book was authored by Joseph Borkin, last name B-O-R-K-I-N, published in hardcover by the Free Press, copyright 1978. And what we're going to, actually, before we get to that, I want to read a portion of a list of the companies that are being sued, or defendants, all but one of which are companies that are being sued by veterans of the Persian Gulf War. There are some 83 companies, the vast majority of them, by the way, are either German, European, or from a neutral country. About 20 of them or so are American corporations, although many of these are obviously American subsidiaries of foreign corporations. Some 33 of these corporations are German. This is the list, again, of defendants in a class action suit that is being pursued by Persian Gulf War Syndrome, or a Gulf War veteran suffering from Gulf War Syndrome. This list as of March 1st, 1996. By the way, this list is being circulated by Joyce Riley. That is a nurse who had tended some Gulf War veterans and contracted Gulf War Syndrome. Joyce Riley can be reached by fax at area code 713-438-4581. That's 713-438-4581. By voicemail at 713-587-5437. That's 713-587-5437. You can write to registered nurse Joyce Riley, last name R-I-L-E-Y, at 2931 Highland Lakes, Missouri City, Texas, 77459. That's 2931 Highland Lakes, Missouri City, Texas, 77459. Now, in this list of companies, companies numbers 34 through 38. Now, again, these are companies being sued by the Gulf War veterans are, and reading numbers 34 through 38, number 34, Degussa AG, German company. Number 35, Degussa Antwerpen NV, Belgian company. Number 36, Degesch GmbH, German company. Number 37, Detia Degesch GmbH, German company. And 38, Degesch America Incorporated, Delaware Corporation, primary place of business in Texas. Now the names Degesch and Degussa will ring very familiar to veterans or to students of World War II history. These are subsidiaries or companies controlled by IG Farben, and they made the Zyklon B for the concentration camps in World War II. Turning again to the book, The Crime and Punishment of IG Farben, authored by Joseph Borkin, B-O-R-K-I-N, and published in hardcover by the Free Press, copyright 1978. Talking about the use of Zyklon B, an insecticide, on concentration camp victims at Auschwitz, only one firm, Deutsche Gesellschaft für, and I'm not going to even attempt this, German Corporation for Pest Control, known in the trade as Degesch, that's one that's among the companies being sued by the Gulf War veterans, supplied this lethal chemical. Again, that's Degesch, D-E-G-E-S-C-H. Continuing, the firm and its most valuable asset, the monopoly of Zyklon B manufacture, was owned 42.5% by IG Farben Industry, 42.5% by Deutsche Gold und Silberscheidenschalt, known as Degussa, D-E-G-U-S-S-A, in which IG owned a third, and 15% by Theo Goldschmidt concern. That IG dominated Degesch was general knowledge in the chemical industry. In fact, in its official corporate pronouncements, Degesch described itself as an exclusive selling agent for IG. Moreover, IG dominated the Degesh Supervisory Board. Of its 11 members, 5 were from IG, including the chairman, Wilhelm Mann, capital M-A-N-N. 5 months after Hess's introduction of Zyklon B, Himmler's personal program to exterminate the Jewish people was transformed into the official policy of the Third Reich. And again, Degesh and Degussa, two of the companies being sued by the Gulf War veterans. Skipping down more about the adaptive use of the Zyklon B, a pesticide. In the past, the SS had brought moderate amounts of Zyklon B from Degesh as a vermin control in its concentration camps. When the final solution added Jews to the SS extermination plans, Degesh profits reflected the new prosperity. IG's dividends on its Degesh investments for the years 1942, 3, and 4 were double those of 1940 and 41. At least one top official of Degesh, Gerhard Peters, the managing director, definitely knew about the new use of Zyklon B. He had been specifically informed of the details of the final solution by Kurt Gerstein, the chief disinfection officer of the SS, who did the purchasing of Zyklon B. There was still another episode that gave the officials of Degesh more than a hint of the dread purpose to which their Zyklon B was being put by the SS. When manufactured as a pesticide, Zyklon B contained a special odor or indicator to warn human beings of its lethal presence. The inclusion of such a warning odor was required by German law. When the SS demanded that the new, large order of Zyklon B omit the indicator, no one familiar with the workings of the SS could have failed to realize the purpose behind the strange request. The Degesh executives at first were unwilling to comply, but compassion was not behind their refusal. What troubled them was the fact that the SS request endangered Degesh's monopoly position. The patent on Zyklon B had long since expired. However, Degesh retained its monopoly by a patent on the warning odor. To remove the indicator was bad business, opening up the possibility of unwelcome competition. The SS made short shrift of this objection, and the company removed the warning odor. Now, the doomed would not even know it was Degesh's Zyklon B. Note again, Degesh and Degussa that produced the Zyklon B being sued by the Gulf War veterans. Note also that it was a pesticide. There is a searing irony about that, because in helping to develop Saddam Hussein's chemical and biological warfare capability, once again, the ironic use of, quote, pesticides, unquote, came into being from a propagandistic standpoint. Recalling the section of the Death Lobby, How the West Armed Iraq, by Kenneth Timmerman, that I read earlier in this broadcast, recall Saddam Hussein's uncle and ideological mentor, the pro-Nazi Khairallah al-Tulfa. He became one of the founding, one of the ideological pivots of the Ba'ath Party, and also became fantastically wealthy. Speaking of the extremely wealthy Khairallah al-Tufa, by the way, he was not only Saddam's uncle, he was also his father-in-law, worth some $500 million and in control through his wife of some 17 companies. But speaking of Khairallah al-Tufa, Kenneth Timmerman writes, but money was not enough for the aging patriarch. In 1981, he decided it was time to make his contribution to eternal Ba'ath Party doctrine as well. He penned a scurrilous pamphlet that was widely distributed by local party cells. Its title was long but explicit. 3 God should not have made: Persians, Jews, and flies. Persians, al-Tufa wrote, were animals God created in the shape of humans, unquote. Jews were a mixture of the dirt and leftovers of diverse peoples, unquote. As for flies, they were a trifling creation, quote, whom we do not understand God's purpose in creating, unquote. For all three, the Ba'ath Party had a solution which it broadcast throughout the Arab world thanks to the powerful French transmitters of Baghdad's Voice of the Masses. Quote, there was a certain insecticide for every type of insect, unquote, Baghdad radio proclaimed. It was an Iraqi attempt at humor. Like most Ba'ath Party jokes, its punchline was death. The German community in Baghdad was thriving, and West German trade with Iraq was up. More than 100 German companies were doing business with Baghdad. Dozens maintained full-time offices in the Iraqi capital. One was Karl Kolb GmbH, a medium-sized chemicals concern from Dreieich, a trading estate close to the Frankfurt Airport. By the way, that firm, Carl Kolb, is the number 68 on the list of companies being sued by the Gulf War veterans, and this being circulated by Joyce Riley. Continuing, its Baghdad representative was a 55-year-old German named Klaus Franzl, F-R-A-N-Z-L. Franzl was more than just a sales representative. Court documents show he was a major shareholder in the Carl Kolb Company, having provided 540,000 Deutschmarks in startup capital. Franzl had been working in Baghdad for years and knew Omar al-Sadi and the Baathists well. One of his favorite hangouts was a belly-dancing joint called the Al-Wiya Club, where patrons could drink French champagne and eat mazgouf while rubbing shoulders with some of the regime's most senior officials. This may be where he first heard of the Samara project, one of the two pesticide plants that Omar al-Sadi planned to build. In the months following the Israeli raid on Osirak, Franzl succeeded in having his company appointed as the main contractor for that plant. While the Samara deal was certainly worth millions to Franzl and his colleagues, it may have appealed to him for other reasons as well. Customs investigators who searched Franzl's home in Dreieich years after Samara had become a synonym for death found a large oil painting that showed Franzl wearing a Wehrmacht order from the Third Reich on his chest. Like Anton Ierlies, his sympathy for Saddam Hussein's regime appears to have gone far beyond his taste for the excellent wages the Iraqis paid. Franzl's partners in Germany were all younger men. The most important was Helmut Mayer, M-A-I-E-R, managing director for Carl Kolb. Born on December 28, 1932, Mayer was too young to have fought in the Wehrmacht, but he was old enough to remember Germany's Nazi past. Mayer and Franzl contracted with a recently created Iraqi entity, the State Establishment for Pesticides Production, or SEPP, to build an entire chemical weapons complex at Samara. Of course, the planned use of the Kolb facilities was never mentioned in the contract. For the two Germans, and for the host of subcontractors who helped build Samara, this was merely a plant for making insecticides. They knew about flies, but they pleaded ignorance about Saddam's feeling toward Persians and Jews. And Degussa was also involved with helping to arm Saddam Hussein with his nuclear capability as well. More about Degussa and Saddam's new capability from the Death Lobby by Kenneth Timmerman. Two transactions that spring heightened fears that Iraq intended to use the Osirak reactor to produce bomb-grade plutonium. An Italian company, in a semi-clandestine deal, sold Iraq 6 tons of depleted uranium purchased from the West German nuclear consortium, NUKEM. Conferring that NUKEM, N-U-K-E-M, might not deliver the uranium if they knew it was intended for Iraq, the Italians claimed it was for domestic use in Italy. But they needn't have worried about NUKEM's scruples. The consortium was a wholly owned subsidiary of the German chemicals giant Degussa, which had invented and manufactured Zyklon B, the powerful cyanide gas that streamed out of the showerheads in Hitler's death camps, killing millions of European Jews. Degussa had also played a key role in the Nazi effort to build an atom bomb, stopped only when its Oranienburg works near Berlin were flattened by U.S. bombers in 1945. That same year, as the Third Reich was going up in flames, Degussa's chairman, Hermann Schlosser, donated 45,000 Reichmarks to Hitler's SS. 35 years later, Schlosser, S-C-H-L-O-S-S-E-R, was still on the Degussa board, and in 1987 he was awarded the German Federal Merit Cross for his services to industry. One of Schlosser's services was shipping nuclear equipment and materials to almost every developing nation that was known to have a clandestine bomb program. Another was opening the vast Iraqi market to German firms. His readiness to supply nuclear materials to both India and Pakistan had impressed on Saddam Hussein that this was a man he could do business with. Only months after the triangular deal with Italy, NUKEM offered to sell the Iraqis even more uranium. The deal would have gone through if it hadn't been for alert regulatory officials in the United States and Canada, who suspected NUKEM of hiding the real identity of its client. When they learned that the fuel pins were destined for Iraq, they blocked the sale. As one of the officials who worked on the case was quick to point out, quote, "This came from the same people who brought us Zyklon B," unquote. And skipping down, the very existence of a weapons industry in West Germany was a closely guarded secret all through the 1950s and 1960s. As the years went by, most of the same technology concerns that had helped build Hitler's Third Reich were born again from the ashes of World War II. And by the way, one of the main reasons for that was their cartel agreements with many of their American counterparts in this transatlantic financial and industrial axis. By the way, the relationship between Newchem, Degussa, and I.G. Farben discussed in a miscellaneous archive show entitled South Africa, the Third Reich, and the Bomb, that available from Spitfire. By the way, the address, etc. for Spitfire, Spitfire, S-P-I-T-F-I-R-E, P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, zip code 95005. The email address is A-L-C-A-L-A-M-E, that's A-L-C-A-L-A-M-E, at ix.netcom.com. You can check out a list of and description of the various programs available from Spitfire on the interactive KFJC website. Point your web browser at www.kfjc.org. Once again, www.kfjc.org, and look in the public affairs section. That concludes this half-hour segment. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening. All righty, welcome back once again to the KFJC Month of Mayhem. Memorial Day weekend, Uncle Sam and the Swastika special, the story of the collaboration between corporate America and the fascist powers of World War II, and the aftermath of that collaboration and the implications couldn't be exaggerated and run up to the very present. We're in the middle of a pair of half-hour segments entitled Uncle Sam and the Swastika Redux, in which some of the original Uncle Sam and the Swastika program from May 23rd of 1980 is reprised, only in the context of the Persian Gulf War and in the context of Gulf War syndrome. Broadcasting from Foothill College, this is KFJC Los Altos Hills. What we're going to do is to go directly to this next half-hour segment. This is, obviously, a half-hour in length. Those of you who are taping, please get ready to do so. 3, 2, 1, here we go. Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and in this next half-hour segment, we're going to continue with a discussion of some of the corporate entities being sued by the Gulf War veterans who are suffering from Gulf War syndrome. There is a list of some 83 entities, all but one of which are corporations. Most of the corporations are either German, European, or in other third world countries or some unnamed foreign country. Also, quite a few of them are American. This list of corporations is being circulated by this list of defendants being sued by the Gulf War veterans. And by the way, this list is as of 3/1/96. It's being circulated by Joyce Riley, a registered nurse, R-I-L-E-Y. You can write to her at 2931 Highland Lakes, Missouri City, Texas, 77459. That's 2931 Highland Lakes, Missouri City, Texas, 77459. Her voicemail is area code 713-587-5437. That's 713-587-5437. Fax number is 713-438-4581. That's 713-438-4581. And we're going to examine some of the companies that are being sued by the Gulf War veterans, because there is a surprising degree of overlap between the companies being sued by the Gulf War veterans and the companies that figured in the transatlantic financial and industrial axis that I have been citing now for the better part of two decades as having been central not only to the prosecution of the Third Reich's war-making industries, but they were central to supporting Mussolini as well, and they also were central, they played a key role in the rise of Adolf Hitler politically as well. Now, recall in the first half-hour segment, we took a look at five of the companies being sued, Degussa, two subsidiaries of Degussa and three of Degesh. Those are two IG Farben subsidiaries that made the Zyklon B for the gas chambers in World War II. They also helped to arm Saddam Hussein with a lot of his nuclear capability. And also, they were involved with making some of the poison gas plants for Saddam Hussein as well, using the excuse that they were being manufactured for pesticide use. Zyklon B was originally a pesticide as well. When I discussed the Dawes and Young plan in the Uncle Sam and the Swastika program that I did on May 23rd, 1980, I mentioned that as a result of the concentration of economic capital that took place in Germany under the Dawes and Young plan, three huge cartels grew up, and they represented not only the backbone of German war-making industry, but they were instrumental in supporting the rise of Hitler as well. They were the IG Farben industry, AEG, or German General Electric, and Vereinigte Stahlwerke, or United Steel, not to be confused with U.S. Steel. We're going to turn now to Vereinigte Stahlwerke, which ultimately was renamed Thyssen AG. That's capital T-H-Y-S-S-E-N, named after the prominent German steelmaker Fritz Thyssen, one of Adolf Hitler's earliest political backers. We're going to turn now to a book called Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile. This book was authored by Paul Manning, M-A-N-N-I-N-G, a colleague of Edward R. Murrow's and Walter Cronkite's in covering World War II for the CBS network. He, by the way, covered the air war in Europe, among other things, and as such was trained as a waste gunner on a B-17 and was actually credited with shooting down an ME-109 in combat because the aircraft could not carry excess weight, so any journalist who wanted to go with them had to be a trained part of the crew. Paul Manning authored his remarkable book about the remarkable and deadly Bormann Flight Capital Organization, an element that I believe will prove to be the decisive factor in human affairs. Perhaps I'm wrong, but that is my opinion. This book was published, again, in 1981 by Lyle Stewart and Company, ISBN number 0-8184-0309-8. Of the renaming of Vereinigte Stahlwerke as Thyssen AG after the Nazi Party appropriated Vereinigte Stahlwerke from Fritz Thyssen, Paul Manning writes in Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, as follows. Speaking of Fritz Thyssen, Manning writes, Nazi authorities had seized his Vereinigte Stahlwerke AG, now Thyssen AG, Germany's largest steel and coal combine at that time, stripping him of his German nationality subsequent to his flight to Switzerland on September 2, 1939, with his wife, daughter, son-in-law, and grandson. In a signed deposition of the Office of the Director of Intelligence, U.S. Group Control Council, on September 4, 1945, he stated that he had been forced to leave Germany because he had opposed the war and objected to the treatment of Catholics and Jews and to such Nazis as Goebbels, Hitler, Rosenberg, and Ley. He also felt that Goering had coveted his successful steel combine. Yet, in a document from the U.S. Financial Intelligence Group dated April 30, 1948, Berlin, it was concluded that among the German industrialists, Fritz Thyssen was a main promoter of the National Socialist doctrine both before and after Hitler's seizure of power. As chairman of Vereinigte Stahlwerke, he played a decisive role in the Führer's rise through his generous contributions to the party and by pressuring fellow industrialists to support Adolf Hitler. Now again, Vereinigte Stahlwerke was renamed Thyssen AG after Fritz Thyssen. Turning to the list of companies being sued by the Gulf War veterans, this is a list of 83 defendants. Number 39 is Thyssen AG, German company. Number 40, Thyssen Incorporated, obviously an American subsidiary, Delaware Corporation, primary place of business in Texas. Number 41 is the Budd Company, that's capital B-U-D-D, Foreign Corporation Home Office in Michigan. Keep that in mind. We're going to come back to the Budd Corporation. By the way, not to confuse with the brewing company. Number 42 is Thyssen Specialty Steels Incorporated, Foreign Corporation Home Office in Illinois. Skipping down to number 45, Thyssen Steel Group, Delaware Corporation, registered agent in Texas. Number 47, Thyssen Stahl AG, German company. 48, Thyssen Aktiengesellschaft, German company. 49, Thyssen Rheinstahl Technik, GmbH, German company. 50, Thyssen Handelsunion AG, German company. 51, Thyssen Industry AG, German company. 52, Thyssen Industry Aktiengesellschaft, German company. 53, Thyssen Maschinenbau, German company. Obviously, these are all subsidiaries of Thyssen AG. That is the name for Vereinigte Stahlwerke, the company, one of the three giant cartels that grew up in Germany as a result of the Dawes and Young plan, and that helped to support Hitler politically and then elevated Hitler to the position, or actually provided the backbone of German war-making industry. Now, as I read that list of the various Thyssen subsidiaries that are being sued by the Gulf War veterans, bear in mind that one of the companies I mentioned was the Budd Company, Foreign Corporation Home Office in Michigan. The Budd Company was purchased by, surprise, surprise, Thyssen AG. Turning once again to the book Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile by Paul Manning, of Thyssen's purchase of Budd, we read, in January of 1978, these two lead banks, acting through the UBS DB Corporation, an American firm of the Union Bank of Switzerland and the Deutsche Bank of Germany, would be the financial advisors for Thyssen AG in its $275 million cash takeover of the Bud Company of Troy, Michigan, a leading U.S. manufacturer of auto components, truck trailers, and rail cars. UBSDB Corporation would also say that the West German companies it represented were showing a, quote, very substantial interest in all sorts of American ventures, including mergers and acquisitions, unquote. So again, please note that Thyssen AG, that company and many of its subsidiaries and proprietary companies comprising a nice chunk of the companies that are being sued as defendants by the Gulf War veterans in their class action suit. Bear in mind there are a total of 83 defendants in that particular suit. What we're going to do now is to go back once again to the Uncle Sam and the Swastika Archive show recorded May 23rd, 1980, and we're going to hear about some of the cartel agreements that existed on both sides of the Atlantic. These cartel agreements are part and parcel to this transatlantic financial and industrial axis that we looked at in connection with the arming and financing of America's enemies in World War II, and they were also, this transatlantic financial and industrial axis, also obviously centrally involved in the arming of America's enemies in the Gulf War as well. Once again, we're going to turn to Uncle Sam and the Swastika, subtitled American Industrial Support for Nazi Germany, and this recorded May 23rd, 1980.
The sort of transatlantic financial axis, its existence permitted the Germans to work out a marvelous, really an evil, but very marvelous system of economic warfare against all of their allies. By manipulating international cartel agreements, they were able to not only obtain valuable technology and raw materials for themselves, but they were able to actually restrict war production in their enemies and potential enemies. A superb but long out of print book entitled All Honorable Men discusses this. The book All Honorable Men was written by a man named James Stuart Martin. And James Stuart Martin was chief of the economic warfare section of the U.S. Department of Justice during the Second World War, and as such, one of his duties was to investigate potential production bottlenecks in German industry, which would offer the Air Force a good opportunity to disrupt German wartime manufacturing. And of this search for bottlenecks and what he discovered through that, James Stuart Martin writes, "As we worked on the search for bottlenecks in German production, we began to find a close relation between international business agreements for the restriction of production and the kinds of products which were especially critical in wartime. The trouble was that these international arrangements, which pointed up the importance of certain commodities in the German economy, had also resulted in restriction of production in the United States. Assistant Attorney General Arnold's men found that one company, Rome and Haas of Philadelphia, was not able itself to produce enough transparent plastic sheets for bomber noses. But because Roman Haas of Philadelphia had DuPont under a special agreement as part of a more complex and wider four-way arrangement involving DuPont and two German firms, IG Farben Industry and Roman Haas of Darmstadt, DuPont was permitted to turn out only a limited quantity of the plastic sheets. While government expediters were tearing their hair over slow deliveries, DuPont was writing to Roman Haas of Philadelphia that they would have to tell the government about the agreement unless Roman Haas would lift the restriction. We discovered even more spectacular complications, such as those in the three-way arrangements among the aircraft equipment firms Bendix of the United States, Siemens of Germany, and Zenith in England. Under one of those arrangements, the American firm in 1941 had stood by an agreement with the Siemens firm of Germany and forbade British Zenith to grant patent licenses so that the British Air Ministry could expand production of aircraft carburetors. Almost a year after Dunkirk, Zenith wrote to Bendix that, quote, the ministry suggested they would prefer to manufacture the carburetors themselves and asked us to waive all our rights in the matter. We have told them plainly that we are not prepared under any circumstances to agree to this or to alter one item of our contract with you. You know that we have got to win the war if we are going to survive, and it is because we know we shall win and survive that we are anxious that post-war business should not be complicated by departing from the conditions of the contract in the meantime and under the excuse of war conditions. As the war went on, Senate committees probing production bottlenecks in the United States helped to compile and make public the records of a staggering number of similar arrangements, differing in detail but all having the same effect. They were widely denounced, but principally on the ground that they represented business as usual during wartime. Editorial solemnly pronounced that all such arrangements should be out for the duration, unquote. These business arrangements operated at focal points where it was possible to turn on and off the main valves in economic pipelines. It was not long before we found out that the arrangement of valves and pipelines was a two-way affair. Our elation at the discovery that practically all of Germany's fine optical glass came from one factory, the Schott Works at Jena, was counteracted by the discovery that under the same working arrangement, only one such factory of any importance existed in the United States.
Now, bear in mind the Schott Works at Jena that you heard described in Uncle Sam and the Swastika. By the way, that book, All Honorable Men, was published by Little Brown in 1950. Okay, and James Stewart Martin was head of the Antitrust Division of the Economic Warfare Section of the Department of Justice. Now, bearing in mind the Schott Works at Jena that you just heard described, turning once again to the list of corporations being sued by the Gulf War veterans in their class action suit as of March 1st, 1996, number 71 is Schott Corporation, New York Corporation. Number 72, Schott Glaswerke, German company. That's spelled the same way, S-C-H-O-T-T. Number 71, obviously, is the American subsidiary. Schott Glaswerke is the German company that was the parent company. That's the same company that was part of this transatlantic financial and industrial axis that I spoke about in 1980 in connection with the Second World War. And obviously, many of those companies were front and center in the arming and equipping of Saddam Hussein as well, to the detriment of many of our Gulf War veterans. Now, in connection with Saddam Hussein's capability for weapons of mass destruction, all U.S. service personnel are now going to be inoculated for anthrax. Information about this, and this again in connection with the very real possibility of military action in the Gulf War. By the way, this is being recorded for the benefit of people who eventually hear it on tape. On February 8th of 1998, the San Francisco Chronicle of Tuesday, December 16th of 1997, had the following article by Marlene Simmons, C-I-M-O-N-S, of the Los Angeles Times. It's datelined Washington headline, Anthrax Shots for All U.S. Troops, subtitled Germ War Protection. The article reads, the Pentagon announced yesterday that it will inoculate an estimated 2.4 million uniformed personnel and reservists against deadly anthrax, the first time the U.S. military has conducted such a program to protect against a germ warfare agent. Defense Secretary William Cohen said he decided to start the $130 million program after a three-year study showed that vaccination is the surest way to guard against an almost universally fatal agent. Quote, this is a force protection issue, unquote, Cohen said, again quoting, to be effective, medical force protection must be comprehensive, well-documented, and consistent. I have instructed the military to put such a program in place, unquote. The vaccine will first be given next summer to 100,000 troops in the high-threat areas of the Persian Gulf and Southwest Asia. Within the next several years, it will be given to all troops numbering about 1.5 million, as well as those reservists who routinely train and would be likely to be called to active duty in an emergency, Pentagon officials said. The Pentagon has increased its scrutiny of the danger of biological weapons since the 1991 Persian Gulf War, when U.S. soldiers came under the very real threat of unconventional weapons for the first time since World War I. Terrorist bombings aimed at U.S. troops in Saudi Arabia and fears that enemies such as Iraq and North Korea might use biological weapons prompted the Pentagon initiative, officials said. Moreover, the decision comes amid the continuing dispute with Iraq's Saddam Hussein over U.N. attempts to gain access to his weapons arsenal. Now, please note that because of Saddam Hussein's CBW capability, all U.S. service personnel are about to be inoculated for or against anthrax. We have already noted that the transatlantic financial and industrial axis, which not only helped to arm Hitler and but also was instrumental in the rise of Hitler, or many of whose members were instrumental in the political rise of Hitler, we've noted that many of those same corporate entities, from Vereinigte Stahlwerke or now Thyssen AG to some of the IG subsidiaries that were manufacturing the poison gas for the gas chambers, were also the gas chambers of World War II and the concentration camps, were also instrumental in arming Saddam Hussein with his CBW and nuke capabilities. And they are now, some of those companies now being sued by the Gulf War veterans. We're going to turn now to Newsweek magazine of November 24th of 1997. There is an article in this issue of Newsweek about the threat, Saddam Hussein's weapons of mass destruction, talking about biological warfare. This is an article called The Terrors of Toxin, subtitled The Science Behind Saddam's Scary Weapons by Jeffrey Cowley, C-O-W-L-E-Y, and Adam Rogers, R-O-G-E-R-S. And skipping down into this article, we find the following statement. Speaking of biological warfare production and the ease with which they can be disguised, what's more, any laboratory equipped to make vaccines can easily churn out deadly biological material. Quote, a UN inspector may think everything is fine if he visits on the same day you're producing vaccine, unquote, Franz says. That's Colonel David Franz, commander of the U.S. Army Medical Research Institute of Infectious Diseases. That, by the way, inhabits the former Fort Detrick with the National Cancer Institute's Molecular Oncology Laboratory, instrumental, apparently, in the development of the Merck Hepatitis B vaccine that many authors have, many researchers have implicated in the development of AIDS. Beginning again, quote, a UN inspector may think everything is fine if he visits on the day you're producing vaccine, unquote, Franz says. Again, quoting, a week later, you can be producing biological warfare agents, unquote. And note again the ambiguous use of biological facilities. The thing that I found striking about that is that the company that makes the vaccines for the U.S. Army and the largest manufacturer of vaccines in the world is Merck Sharp & Dohme, and that's the American subsidiary of the Merck Corporation, which, as I've discussed in numerous past broadcasts, is a German corporation. Turning now to the book Emerging Viruses, AIDS and Ebola, Nature, Accident, or Intentional, a landmark work authored by Dr. Leonard Horowitz and published in hardcover by Tetrahedron Incorporated, copyright 1996. The ISBN number is 0-923-550-12-7. The Merck Company is centrally involved in not only U.S. biological warfare development, it is also the largest manufacturer of vaccines in the world, and it manufactures the vaccines for the U.S. Army. Of the history of Fort Detrick, the that was a history of Fort Detrick, that was issued by Fort Detrick. The author's name, by the way, is Covert, ironically enough. From the moment of its birth, this, by the way, quoted in Emerging Viruses, from the moment of its birth in the highest levels of government, the fledgling biological warfare effort was kept to an inner circle of knowledgeable persons. George W. Merck, M-E-R-C-K, was a key member of the panel advising President Franklin D. Roosevelt and was charged with putting such an effort together. Merck owned the pharmaceutical firm that still bears his name. Skipping down, my surprise was based on the knowledge that the hepatitis B vaccine Strecker alleged infected the American gay community was almost certainly manufactured by Merck's company. To confirm my suspicions, I dug out the New England Journal of Medicine report that I had studied years earlier. The paper reported that indeed the homosexual hepatitis B vaccine study had been supported, quote, by a grant from the Department of Virus and Cell Biology of Merck Sharp & Dohme Research Laboratories, West Point, Pennsylvania. And still later in Emerging Viruses, Leonard Horowitz writes of the Merck Company, the German-owned Merck Company, after all, funded the study, this of the experimental hepatitis B vaccine. The German-owned Merck Company, after all, funded the study and produced the experimental and control vaccines.